Blog Talk Radio.
In the beginning was the beat, and the beat was the rhythm of God, and the rhythm of God is the harmony of humanity, and where there is harmony, there is peace.
Welcome to all of you in our listening audience to the Us Lifting Us regular Thursday night radio broadcast, Dare to Win. We appreciate having you, and we invite you to join us as we have sober discussion about the economic and political plight of Black people and the cooperative economic model that provides an exact method of gaining economic and political self-determination. We are building the global machinery for our economic freedom and sovereignty, and the methodology to pass it forward to future generations. So thank you for being here. We're going to have a lively discussion this evening. Stick around and please participate.
But we deserve. We've been duped, and we've been scorned. We've been treated bad, talked about as sure as you want. But just as sure as it takes you eyes to make a pair, brother, we can't quit until we get our share.
Once again, welcome. welcome to Dare to Win. Thank you for being here with us this evening. I am Sister Nanana, and I'm a board member of Us Lifting Us, Economic Development Cooperative. And I am very pleased and honored to be your host this evening on the Dare to Win radio program. We invite you to participate and to join the discussion. You can do that by calling 929-477-2789 and press the number 1 on your phone keypad. Or you can go to the ULU website, www.usliftingus.com, and click on the ULU radio tab. After that, look for the link to click, which allows you to join us online. But we are so pleased to be here and to have you joining us. This evening, our guest is Brother Shabaka, who is also an ULU board member. Welcome, Brother Shabaka. How are you this evening?
Greetings, Sister Nanana, and greetings to your radio guests and family. My pleasure to be here.
Hopefully, we're
going to have a very enlightening conversation.
I'm sure we are. This is a wonderful subject that we're going to be discussing this evening, one that is certainly enlightening and eye-opening. The subject that we're talking about this evening, or the question that we're going to be discussing, is how is gentrification, reparations, and Black economic empowerment connected, and how is ULU's business model the key to African sovereignty? Boy, that's a lot right there. That's a real mouthful, isn't it? How is gentrification, reparations, and Black economic empowerment connected, and how is ULU's business model the key to African sovereignty? Well, Brother Shabaka, we're looking forward to having you help us to unravel this subject and to provide us with some pertinent information on this very timely topic. So tell us, Brother Shabaka, what you see as an appropriate response to start us out on that question.
Well, thank you very much, Sister Nanana, for posing that question. It is a extremely important question because I think it really hits at every fabric of our being, you know, being here in the U.S. And it's such that this phenomena is not only in the U.S., it is global. But I think a real adequate discussion on this would probably go beyond the time allotted for this program. But let me try to take a stab at it by first trying to have us focus a little bit on what is and describing it to give an idea of how it happens to affect us, its evolution, and the role that it plays right now. Going through my studies on this topic and looking at a number of European scholars, and so I found a very interesting definition that I think that the family would probably really appreciate. Europeans describe gentrification this way: as a process of renovating deteriorated urban neighborhoods by means of the influx of more affluent residents. In other words, their description is a little more than what we would do in order to renovate our homes. And in so doing, they exonerate themselves for any reason or cause for the deterioration of the neighborhood. Now, remember now, it is by use of our labor that we build the neighborhood. If they let the neighborhood crumble, deteriorate, it's because they who controls the money have not allowed it to be infused to sustain and keep the neighborhood up. They look at it as a positive process. In other words, the removal of certain peoples and bringing an influx of what they consider more affluent people. Another way of looking at it is the particularly when we look at it in the context of Africans and Europeans, is the shifting of the neighborhood's racial and ethnic composition and the average household income by developing new and more expensive housing and businesses, thereby causing the initial residents of the neighborhood to move because they no longer can afford the financial necessities of trying to sustain and keep it up. I think more importantly in our discussions as we continue it is to look at the word gentrification in and of itself. The root word of that is gentry. Now, my examination of this word, and probably a number of members of the family also are found this themselves, is a European context which describes a class of people just below the nobility in position. All right, in the modern setting, we would probably call these people upper classes, upper middle class, privileged class, the wealthy, the elite, high society, and, of course, the establishment. These are some of the terminologies that we have used, I know, during the time in which I've been coming up, and I'm sure your time also. Of interest and importance is the word wealthy. Now, individuals are considered wealthy and affluent or rich if they have accumulated substantial wealth relative to other members of the society. In other words, my wealth is a consequence of my ability to accumulate more of it than other people that reside in the society in which I live or dwell. And so we see that wealth has a fundamental importance, you know, as we look at gentrification, because we see affluent people coming in. If we look at it in the context of African people, then we know Europeans can easily come in and supplant us, because African people in comparison to Europeans have less wealth. In fact, Dr. Claude Anderson has done a number of research and writings on this subject. And so it's almost like, if I could use a scientific term, we know that cold air tends to be more dense than warmer air, all right, and therefore it's heavier. So therefore it pushes out air that is less dense. Therefore, wealth, more wealth, pushes out an area which is less wealth. And consequently, African people in the U.S. Do not have the necessary wealth based on our relationship to the transatlantic slave trade, slavery, and, of course, every of the ills that have taken place since slavery was abolished and stopped. So we see yes, go ahead, sister. Did you have a comment or question at the end?
No, I was just thinking to myself how broad this particular subject is, and the definition that you started us out with, which is a definition that has been crafted by the Europeans who hold the economic power, would make it appear that gentrification is almost innocuous, that
yes,
if anything, it has nothing but a positive effect, and as a matter of fact, that the gentry who come in are pretty much doing us a favor. That's the implication that I get from the definition. That's just the thought that was going through my mind as you were speaking.
Yes, and not only they look at themselves more or less doing themselves a favor, and we just happen to receive the brunt of that favor. But as they come in, and let me use the examples, I'm a familiar, I could use Baltimore, but I think a case in point is what is happening now in South Florida, particularly the Miami area. the area that is constantly being sought at this point is the black areas. The Little Haiti and particularly Liberty City, you know, areas in Miami. They're elevated areas in Miami, such that now wealthy, affluent whites and Cubans want to occupy because of the so-called global warming and the rising of the sea. It's hitting the coastal areas, all right? Can you picture it now? But the higher elevations is in the black areas, particularly the African-American, Africans who were born here, and Haitians, all right? And these two communities sit side by side or very close to each other. And they may not have had the best relationships. And I think that probably is a consequence of the leadership of both groups. But in particular, you know, because of the socioeconomic problems that is being extended or represented there, Haitians tends to have some businesses, and they have community centers, and they have a cultural adhesion that allows them to at least navigate the political scenery in Miami a little bit better than the Africans who are born here. All right, then you have also the Bohemian population, which has been there since time immemorial. All right, a little bit stabilized, similarly characterized like the Haitians with little small businesses. And they'll be able to sustain a little bit of the brunt coming from the Europeans and Cuban communities. I'm talking about white Cubans, all right, the white Cuban mm-hmm. community. And so what you see is the affluency, all right, attempting to replace, all right, for their social and economic reason, because they're meeting a crisis, which is the rising of the sea. And as a consequence, they're going to move out this population, care less about this population socioeconomically, all right? And what they have is deprived this population because, one, if you have a state government or a city government in particular, in order to provide services for its residents, it gets taxes from those residents. And now that's both property and income taxes. And in some areas they don't have income, but they do have property taxes. And then they use that to provide services. Well, then the state and the city particularly allows for the development of those areas to sustain those communities, sustain the roads, all right, the traffic lights, provide permits for businesses to go in there, the whole gamut of stuff that they do. But when they don't do that, then the neighborhoods begin to diminish and deteriorate. And as a consequence, all right, then you got land developers that come in. These are the people who are a little bit more affluent than the affluent. So these are what we usually refer to as the 1%. And so they come in and attempt to exploit the situation because they're moving out a population that has little wealth, bringing another population has a little bit more wealth so that they can exploit, all right, to get wealth more. We also hear talk about the gap in income. Also, there's a gap in rent. And that explains fundamentally the whole gentrification process. When the gap is sufficiently wide between the existing resident, all right, and then the developers that came in, all right, then it's easy to push those people out. And then developers come in with the permission of the state administration, which is your mayor, mm-hmm. city council, and what have you, all right, to develop these areas and then bring in middle class or upper middle class who now have rich money. And usually these are young people, relatively young in comparison to our ages, but they're young, 30s, 40s. They are usually professionals. And interestingly or not, these people are also supposedly liberal. They carry a liberal agenda. It's not the white redneck that we make fun of who is trying to push you out. In fact, they don't really want to come there and live next to you. It is the liberal elements that we find that tends to make use of their wealth, all right, and resources to push out that community of folk, generally us, people of African descent, all right, out because we had less wealth and resources to begin to combat, all right, that push. Let me stop
well,
here to see
let
if
me ask this. Uh-huh.
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, let me ask this, Brother Shabaka. It just seems to me that there is a timing factor involved here, and I can't help but think that this whole process of gentrification has been planned to happen at a particular time. So the question that I have is, why is gentrification happening now? It seems to be happening everywhere, and it's all happening, you know, at this particular time frame. So could you please speak to that? But before you speak to that, I just want to remind our listening audience that the call-in number is 929-477-2789, 929-477-2789, and then press the number 1 on your dial to let us know that you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, and we will open your line so you can do so. So, yeah, Brother Shabaka, do you have a perspective on the timing factor that may be going on with gentrification?
Yeah, thank you, sister, for that observation and question. Yes, I do. At least I have in my mind an explanation. As you know, that Europeans tend to plan decades in advance, and they say the Chinese or Asian people plan much longer. And you know that we plan probably for the day. And so, obviously, there's definitely a differences in time conception and perspective when we are interacting with anyone else. But to deal with the thrust of your question, at least according to Europeans, gentrification is not a new phenomenon to them. In fact, they trace the origin of the practice back to the Roman Empire, and in particularly Roman Britain. And Roman Britain is when the Romans occupied Britain back there 2,000 years ago. All right, and then what they did was replace these little shops that the Britons had in order to deal and entertain their commerce. They replaced it with their large villas to make room for the generals, the military, the occupation force. All right, so they removed that population out. And so it's not a new phenomenon. It's new to us in terms of how it is applied. But it's the practice that they have done over an extended period of time, and now all they're doing is reintroducing the practice and maybe refining the practice a little bit as we enter this so-called modern era. But in countries, you know, south, what we call southern countries, you know, Africa, Southern Asia, and Central and South America, if you notice at this time, there is large migrations that are moving north. You got in Africa, there's migrations of Africans who are moving to Europe. This is all around the same time, this time right now. And, of course, we know about the migrations of Central Americans that are moving now. The consequence of that migration is a result of both European and American foreign policies, you know, on those countries, propping up dictatorships, propping up various militaries and overlords, all right, to sustain their particular resource interests in those areas, whether it's the resources that is necessary in order to build the economy that we see here in America and the West in general. And so people leave those areas are being subjected to, you know, brutality, and so they move north. All right. The Europeans, and it all happens as a consequence of the global exploitation of capital, a lot of people refer to this as imperialism. This is capitalism on a global scale, all right, and then forcing these migration as people begin to leave areas where they no longer can economically take care of their families. And so they move to those areas where apparently they see richness, and they see richness not where they are, but in the northern countries. And so you have this migration of people. You have this migration movement. And then this population interact with the population here. How it affects us is that, and, you know, the people from Central America, Latinos, I have no issues with them. I'm just looking at this all in the context of us. We were the principal labor force here. At one time, we were the principal labor force here. All right. We were enslaved. All right, and we had to, all right, and then when we moved and were expelled, well, not expelled, but we left because of the brutality of the South and went north, we was a labor force there. In fact, we was the dominant and majority labor force in the South. All right, and then as we moved and people came over here from Europe, Scotland, and every place else to make go out to the West and find gold and oil and all that other kind of stuff, then, of course, we had the Europeans who became a labor force. All right, we was also skilled labor. We were also skilled labor. And so we migrated from the rural areas to the cities, all right, and as a consequence of that, we was held up in pockets because of the segregation rules that had us. All right, there was no attempt, all right, to educate or do anything else. We had to do those things ourselves. And as a consequence, what seemed like it's all of a sudden happening at this particular time is something that has materialized over periods of time, but it ripples because it's been happening around the same time globally. The southern population moving north.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let me stop you right there with that point, Brother Shabaka, if you don't mind, because I see we have a caller who would like to ask a question. So, caller 9179, last four digits, 9179, would you tell us your name and where you're calling from and then give us your question or your comment?
Omilade Akinola Gonzalez calling from Canton, Ohio.
Thank you.
Greetings, brother.
Thank you for being with us.
Alafia. So I practice a lot of racial work and just the mindset I have. I've been actually all points all over the United States, and I see a lot of repercussions and reparations going on. And it's like a lot of my brothers and sisters, same skin color, different skin color. Like they're all going through the same phases, and it seems like others are actually going through it before others. And some are strong, some are weak, and some can't take it. Some are actually taking their anger out on the same kind that's actually making everyone look bad. But I want to kind of pinpoint on just some things that I've been noticing going on lately, just like a lot of terrible mindsets, a lot of agitation, a lot of irritation. There's like I've seen countless folks that can't keep their concentration, can't keep their cool. They're always shaking. They're always looking like they're about to cry. It's just a lot of tenacity that's going on. And it's just like my question would be like, what motivational things would I have to like keep those guys above head and cool headed?
So your question is, what motivational? I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear it. There was some noise in the background.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm actually doing food delivery. But basically, like, what motivational, like, what could I possibly, you know, just let the young brothers around here know that that they're not alone, you know what I'm saying, that they actually have someone that's out there caring for them, that they're not actually saying, dang, I'm out here by myself, or they're saying I don't have actually no one to actually depend on. So what they do, they actually go out there and do stupid things, and it actually looks bad.
All right. I'm going to ask Brother Shabaka to comment on that, and I'm going to comment on it as well. And thank you so much for the question. We appreciate you calling in. So what might be shared with, what might be said to a young person, young brothers in particular, to let them know that they are not alone in this struggle and in this process to gain economic affluence and security. Brother Shabaka, do you have a? Would you like to answer that question for this young brother?
Yeah, let me try to take a stab at it, brother. I'm glad you're out there, and I'm sure that you, in your experience, you know, you have empathy for the brothers, and you would like to do something. I say, in my own experience, when I found myself coming in situations like that, it's really trying to be patient and then being there if it's possible, and initially listening, and then as the brother exhale and interacts, take him to an event that you think might be uplifting, not overpowering, but might be uplifting to get him or her to begin to broaden his or her vision of what is really happening. Because this process that we have experienced is not something that just happened. It's since we really got off the shore 400 years ago or more. All right, it's just a continuation and a percolation. And some of us have a little bit more insight as to what had happened to us, and there's a few of us that may not have had the privilege of having that insight. So the mere fact of interacting positively with the brother and then bringing him under your wing and taking him to maybe some activities that is conscious building, and then have a discussion, you know, nothing real deep, you know, because the brother is probably injured, and as a consequence, you want him to recover from that injury. But usually he recovers from that injury when he sees a need that he needs to recover from that injury based on his interactions. All right, and right now his interaction may not have been positive. You want to present him with a positive image. And since that falls in line with some of the tactics that are used in order to gentrify a community, number one, and then I'll just quickly say this, and I know you wanted to respond also. Getting in a position where brothers are unemployed, not having work, that impacts the family. Well, that's it's supposed to impact the family because that is exactly what the Europeans want. They want it to negatively impact the family. They want to take the male out of the house. They want to put and incarcerate him. Then that leaves the female with the sole responsibility of taking care of the family. And you know how women are viewed by the European male, you know. All right, so compounded by that, and then when you see drugs thrown in the community, and, you know, they talk about the drugs. We don't manufacture the drugs in the community. In fact, we got documents that show the drugs have been imported coming from as far south as South America, all right, on this hemisphere, but they're also coming from Europe as well as Asia. So you got these drugs coming to our community. You got also, in addition to the drugs, firearms. Well, we can't buy no firearms. A lot of our brothers are, you know, former felons. They can't purchase a firearm. So where do they get the firearms from? They get it illegally. All right, so somebody got to sell it to them illegally. All right, and then you got the crookedness of the police. So when you have this instability as a consequence of crime in the neighborhood, then that the European use that as an excuse to come in, supposedly to rid the community of crime, which you allow it to make safe for the affluent community who don't want that crime. Sister, let me stop here because I know you wanted to respond.
Well, thank you, and I'm going to make a quick response, and then we're going to take a music break. And my response is, I think that particularly younger people in our communities need to be made aware of Us Lifting Us. And they need to know that this is a system and a mechanism that can assist us and that is assisting us to build an economy whereby we can change what is happening in our communities. And so I would invite them to become members of Us Lifting Us, and in doing so, give them an opportunity to start to form relationships with other people of like mind and to grow from there, because Us Lifting Us has a whole community, a global community of people that have many, many resources that are available. And we'll talk more about that a little bit later, but that would be my response to the question that you asked. And thank you so much for asking that question. We appreciate it. And right now we're going to take a short music break, and we will be back in about 2 minutes to continue this discussion. Thank you.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back to thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, wake up. A new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children to jump the very best you can. The world won't get no better if we just let it be. Na 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 na. We gotta change it, yeah, just you and me. Wake up all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the hair. But they don't have so very long before their judgment day. So won't you make them happy before they pass away? Wake up all the builders, time to build a new land. I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our minds. Surely things will work out, they do it every time. The world won't get no better if we just let it be.
All right, we're back with you. This is the Dare to Win, Us Lifting Us, Economic Development Cooperative regular Thursday night radio broadcast. We are here every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and we have sober discussions, serious discussions about economic and political plight of our people and solutions, real solutions that we bring forth to address these issues. And tonight we have Brother Shabaka, an Us Lifting Us board member, who's helping us to understand what's happening with gentrification And we've just gone through some historical perspectives on that and clear definition about what gentrification is. And so, Brother Shabaka, how does gentrification tie in with reparation? That's part of our subject to be discussed this evening. So what's the connection there?
Yeah, thank you, sister, for the question. Like I said earlier, that the question on gentrification, you know, could take, you know, probably several days. But as I wanted to explain, it's really the transferring of wealth, right? Going from, when I say transferring, we know that the wealth gaps get larger and larger. Well, wealth gap can't get larger and larger. Somebody is taking wealth from somebody and hoarding it or accumulating it for themselves. All right, and so this is what's happened. The first people that created the wealth were Africans who were brought here enslaved and made the European and still continue to make the Europeans rich. Its relationship to reparation is fundamental, a corrective. Reparation, as you probably know, is a process for repairing and healing and restoring of people who have been injured as a consequence of their group identity. All right, we being African, all right, the people from Europe have oppressed and persecuted us for centuries and have been in violation of fundamental human rights by the instruments that they use in order to do that, the government, the corporations, the institutions, and, of course, the large family who, in many cases, own these corporations. Those groups have been injured. And they persist in injuring us. And as a consequence, there is a reaction to the person who is receiving the injury to respond back. They don't no longer want to be injured. From 1865 up to the present, the Europeans have not let up one bit, all right, in persecuting, exploiting us, not one bit. In spite of the fact that they initiated and brought into law the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, which was to outlaw slavery and supposedly to make the black man and woman equal to whites. That's what it was supposed to do, and they lied. Ever since then, 1865, we haven't experienced that. Not yet. We've been treated. And from the Jim Crow to the Black Codes, and now in the modern day, or one of the tools that is used is the gentrification to continue the oppressive activity against people of African descent. And when I said wealth, well, let me give you a very historic example that we can create wealth. I'm sure that the family have heard of the success of Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma, around the early 1920s, all right, commanded a lot of, had the industry, had an economy that was set up. In fact, our Europeans were coming to do business because of the sophistication of the economy that they had. I had the pleasure of, you know, visiting and looking at some of the things that were shot, that were there, you know, upon, you know, this is after the fact, some, you know, 60, 70 years after the fact, but still some of the remnants were still there. So you got a view. And so what the Europeans did, even though we had this economy that sustained Africans, you know, the dollar would probably circulate in that community for about a month before it left to buy resources necessary for the community to sustain itself. It was almost sovereign. It was missing one thing. The key asset that it did not have, and that was the assets that the Europeans had, which was the military. It was key because they used, in fact, we think they used the military because from my recollection and from my studies, it looked like Africans who were resisting in Tulsa when the Europeans came to burn down their area, they were being shot from the sky. And the only people I know that had airplanes, and this is in 1921, right after World War One, were the military that had the planes that could shoot and bomb from the sky. So it looked like all facets of the government, local, state, and probably the federal government got involved in putting an end to Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So we see that wealth is a major figure, and wealth is what has been taken away from us. And the reparation movement is one of the things in trying to get and reclaim the wealth that was stolen. It wants the wealth that is necessary to take care of the psychological things. As the brother described earlier in his question, you know, people are being hurt, not clear on where to go, needing that kind of help. Well, this part of the reparation movement is to demand from the exploiters that resources and wealth be directed towards to help folks repair themselves both psychologically and physically. All right? I don't want to talk about the health care system in this country. That's a weak study and conversation. So we were forced, this is people of African descent, to forced into poverty through the enslavement and Jim Crow, and then the continued enslavement, and then now gentrification. So reparations attend to repair and to be counter to what we have. And you look at gentrification as a continued vestiges of the injustices that we have received. And the instruments are there that the state uses in order to try to move us around, rob us more of our wealth, and then leave us out to dry. Obviously, we know about state, the taxation, the unfair taxation with some of us, the law, the court system. You know, we get sentenced twice as much, and the imprisonment, mass incarceration, and, of course, the brutality of the occupation force represented by modern-day police. I want you to look at what we've been talking about and describing, and I want you to look at ethnic cleansing that they talk about that is supposed to be happening in this Sudan, that is supposed to be happening in Myanmar, in Burma, and all that other kind of stuff. Well, it's no different, except it's sophisticated here. We may not be masses of military may not be jumping on us and causing us to move, but the sophistication in creating an environment which is not well for us to stay, and that environment can lead to death in the crimes that are committed as a result of the importation of drugs, the importation of guns. And we know that it's affecting the European population because they're all up in arms about the opioid epidemic that they're claiming about. So all of this results in ethnic cleansing. I don't even like the word use gentrification. It's really ethnic cleansing. And if you want to look at it, it can also be tied to genocide, only in the sense that if we were encased and there was really nowhere to go, all right, then we'll be outright murdered. At least ethnic cleansing allow for the residents to move, or the population that resided in the area to move and relocate. If you can't relocate, all right, although you're being forced because some other entity, an affluent group, wants that area, all right, then you die. If you can't relocate, you die. That's genocide. All right, so the two words, or three words, gentrification, it's just a sanitization of the word, ethnic cleansing, or cleansing of an area, of one group socioeconomically, which happened to have less wealth than another group, and then the other group, all right, if you can't move out fast enough for me to move in, then you die.
Well, I think I'm following
you have a question.
Yeah, I think I'm following the train of thought in that what you are proposing is that reparations would be a solution or a repair for the ethnic cleansing, which is being disguised as gentrification. And so with the, you know, the probability of reparations being somewhat off into the future, is there anything that you can share with us that can be, that we can start concretely working on now? And I guess what I'm leading into at this point is the last part of the initial question that we started out with, and that's around African sovereignty and how that relates to ULU's business model. So can you help us to tie that piece in as we start to work our way to pull all of these elements together? What is the significance of helping to achieve African sovereignty through ULU's business model, and how does that relate to this whole dialogue that we've been having this evening? Brother Shabaka?
Yes, sister. Thank you so much for that question. It's an excellent question and excellent point that you raise. One of the things in our discussion is that you're correct. Reparations, which is resistance and attempting to get back what was stolen, including our humanity, is not going to occur tomorrow, regardless of the presidential candidates, a number of them. I think it's 24 now. You know, and at least a third of them are talking about reparations. All right, but you know, that's just talk. So that's not going to happen. All right, but what can happen in the interim is this: we have some models. We have the Black Wall Street model, with people who were forced to segregate, and they was able to accumulate with the resources that they had, and they set up businesses. They set up an economy. We have other areas in North Carolina, Durham, and what have you. We see similar kinds of things happening in Mississippi, northern part of Mississippi that I visited. I saw those things. So we can pool our resources together, develop businesses, and make those businesses work for us. To the point where we can almost be quasi-sovereign or independent. The model that ULU has is a very simple model. It's what we did when we were forced over 100 years ago to try to sustain ourselves, all right, is to pool our resources, all right? You have resources. We know we have resources because the figures that we get from the Department of Commerce says that Black folks spend, you know, for the past 2 years, near $1 trillion or over $1 trillion. We spend it. So if we're spending that amount of money and not necessarily getting the group benefit from that, sure, we have people here who are millionaires, a couple billionaires and all that, and, yeah, they have their homes here. We have our basketball player, you know, but when you think of their percent of the population, and what they're contributing to the population is not very much or meager. The things that they do is not very much. But we know that we do spend. We have the resources in spite of what we've been experiencing. We do spend. And all we need to do is to organize, all right, the amount of money that we do spend with and have a share of that money go into a pool that will be used to set up businesses, all right, that we did once before. So I'm not talking about something that we've never done. All right, and it's more important that we do it now to develop an economic base. ULU has a formula which allows us to be able to do that, the pooling of our resources. And when those resources accumulate, aggregate, all right, then we use those resources, all right, to identify businesses. All right, if you spend, and I want you to think about this, if you go to a business to spend and buy something, why is it that you can't also have a business that does the exact same thing? You know, when you look at the amount of money that you spend, there's a business that you patronize that provides you with some products, some commodity. Well, why isn't it that you can't also have a business, business owners? Why can't you be a business owner and look like you to do the serve the same thing? All right, it's possible because we've done it before. So it's nothing new. We've done it before. We just have not done it recently. So we have a model to pool our resources. All right, build the businesses. The profits that we get through a formula then can be directed in surplus to come back to us, can be applied to, we got a number of issues, as the brother described earlier. So those things need to be dealt with, and there's organizations within our neighborhoods that attempt to address those issues, but they don't have the resources. All right, well, portions of what we obtain through profits can be directed to them, all right, and can be given out such that they can now do the job to address those folks in severe cases where they've had traumas and help to revitalize them, given to educational institutions. We have our historically black colleges that are no longer acting historically black. They're now into the diversity kind of medium. We need to get them historically black or set up new colleges. So, sister, the pooling of resources, building of businesses, using those businesses to hire our people, using portions of the profits that we or surpluses that we create from successful businesses. You know, we don't just mindly go out and create a business. Distribute it equitably through the community, particularly to organizations that can help us where we need that help, particularly that repair. We're not going to get it right now from the federal government. We're not going to get it from the folks who created the injury to us, the corporations, those institutions, those insurance companies that insured the farms, that insured the slaves, that insured the farms that the farmers in the South had sharecropped. All right, we are not going to get it tomorrow, but we quit with the money that we can accumulate now. We can use that money and pool our resources. So to address the brother's question earlier, as you rightfully said, bring him to a setting that we're going to have with Ulu, and let him feel that he has something to contribute, all right, and then put him to work. He has activity, he has skills. We put him to work. Sister, I didn't want, I know that you're running a little bit on time, so I wanted to just quickly indicate that. Is there something else you needed to ask me? But that's the model.
What I hear you describing is the basic Ulu plan for creating our own economy, and the first step is the pooling of resources, and then using those resources to build businesses, and through those businesses we employ our own people, and then recirculate that money back into our communities. And of course, there's
exactly
more
and sister,
to that model.
Exactly,
than,
it's more to that model.
What,
but yet, yeah, but keep in mind that it's nothing that has not been done. We've done it before, and we have been successful
definitely
before. And we do the statistics are out there. We spend over $1 trillion. We can do it again. I'm sorry for interrupting.
Yes, we definitely can. I agree with you. And I would invite those in the listening audience to take a look at our website, which is usliftingus.com, usliftingus.com, and go through our website, listen to the presentation to really get a clear perspective in terms of what the Ulu program template is all about. it is a plan that is proven and it does work. It is a cooperative economic model, which is a very precise and exact method of gaining economic and political self-determination for our people. As a matter of fact, Cafe Ulu, which is our first business that we have launched, is a working model of the Uplifting Us plan. And I would invite everyone who has not looked at the Cafe Ulu website to go to Cafe Ulu, CafeUlu.com, and to take a look at that website as well to see how this model is actually working in real life and that it does work. I want to thank everyone in our listening audience for being with us this evening, and to say that we're going to be back with you again next week, and we will be continuing to have these discussions and continuing to move forward with building our own economy and with building Ulu. Thank you. Thank you, Brother Shabaka.
No matter what may come our way,
we are going to make it all through.
We will lift every voice and say,
we are going to make it all through.
We are going to make it through. And for our sake, maybe of the much sacrifice.
We are going to make it all through.